Mental Health Monday on Radio City Talk. Tackling the stigma.
Yeah, we're on to episode 3 of Mental Health Monday now. We're going to be talking to a special guest in the studio who is doing some great work when it comes to chasing the stigma around mental health. I put on Twitter a little bit earlier on that in some ways he'd become the poster boy of mental health in the UK. Jake Mills, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
When I put that thing on Twitter about you being the poster boy, unexpected poster boy, I changed it. I deleted it, then I put it back on, and I thought, no, in many ways, Jake Mills is now the face of positive attitudes towards mental health, because a few years ago, you started to tell your story, and as a result of simply telling your story, you're the sort of person now who would feature in a national news broadcast. Mm. You know, you've been just very recently on the 6 o'clock, the 10 o'clock news as well. You do writing for various people. You get invited to posh do's in London and so on and so forth, simply from talking about mental health. And this show is all about talking about mental health. You did that. And as a result of that, you become, it's a poster boy.
Yeah. I mean, and that's pretty much what happened. I only spoke out about what I'd gone through I make it quite clear that I didn't speak out about my kind of personal story to help anyone or to receive any credit or to do anything other than to get it off my chest. That's the only thing that I done it for, was to kind of make it public, because there was certain rumours going around after I tried to take my own life. There were certain rumours going around and that people had kind of picked up on it. And purely as a way of taking it away from them, I spoke out about it on Twitter and said what I'd gone through. And it was just from that moment, really, that I was asked if I could maybe write about it or expand on the points that I'd made. And quickly, before I knew it, there was just people messaging me from all over the country, of different parts of the world, who were saying, not like, oh, well done for speaking out, but people who were saying, you've just described exactly what I'm going through, and I thought I was the only one. And next minute, it's can you do an interview for this newspaper, or can you go on the Lorraine Kelly show to talk about it? And before I knew anything about it, I was kind of doing national interviews. And the more interviews that I did do and continue to do, the more people who get in touch with me asking for help. And that's kind of the point of it, really. I only talk about the experiences that I go through now because people are getting hope from it, from seeing somebody being where they might be now or where they might have been once before and coming through it the other side. And as long as people are getting any hope or finding any kind of positives in my story, then I'll continue to do it. But it is all accidental, definitely, yeah.
Did you find that those sort of people who were asking you for interviews, did you find that they were open-minded about your story? Or did they get a sense that, I don't know, it was a story which appeared to have a bit of legs to it and might get them a few, you know, tweets or retweets, or that it'd be positive social media? Or did you sense that there was a definite sense that talking about this was a story which needed to be told, that maybe hadn't been told before?
A little bit of both, to be honest. Because I do think that there's certain times of the year when I know that I'm going to be asked to do interviews on kind of what I went through. And it's kind of like the World Mental Health Day type of times of the year. And it's almost a little bit like, can we tick this box and then get on with it and forget it? Certainly like on radio interviews, not like this, but on the phone, it's like, it is literally, you'll have a producer who says, hi, you're going to go through to the presenter and he'll talk to you about your experiences. Just hang on the line. And you go through and then they'll talk to you about, you know, really deep personal story. And then they'll just be like, okay, bye. And then or they don't even say bye. Like, you're still hanging on phone and it just goes off. I remember I'd done Radio 2 show and it was Jeremy Vine's show. And Jeremy Vine, and the way that he does, he goes up and down in his voice, he changes the mood constantly, and he's like, okay, so next we've got Jake Mills from Liverpool, who tried to commit suicide after suffering from depression, so we'll be speaking to Jake straight after Uptown Funk by Bruno Mars. And put that, and I was just thinking, do you really actually want to talk to me here, or is it just kind of like a little bit of a, we'll kind of get this interview and then we can tick it off? But a lot of it is because people understand the kind of the importance of it, and I would hope most interviews that I do aren't just asking me about what I went through, they're asking me about how other people can, you know, use my experiences and what I've learned from my experience to help other people.
We're going to talk about the work you're doing with Chasing the Stigma and some of the sorts of people that you're working with. Is there a danger, maybe that was an example of it there, that people think because you're now an organisation that somehow you've got a bit of a barrier in front of you? Presumably your thoughts about what you did when you tried to take your life are still very much there, you know, they happen to you as a person. You're still that person who was in that place. You're not, you know, like a media conglomerate or, you know, a big charity walking around. You're still relatively vulnerable, aren't you?
Yeah, but I think that's important, and that's kind of why I created the charity, was because it is a real-life story. It is a real-life experience, and I think that's what I want the charity to be. I didn't want everything to be about me. I didn't want all the interviews and that, like, you know, the whole poster boy thing. I didn't want it to be about me. I didn't want me to be the focus on it. That's why I created the charity. But the whole essence of the charity is to put normal voices and faces to mental illness, and to say, instead of saying us and them, and if you're going through something, you might be able to go here. It's about saying, I went through something, I went here, and you can too. You can get the help that I did. You can learn from my experience, from other people's experience, and bringing everyone together who offer that help and the support, to just to be in one place and to say, yeah, it's us. We're all the normal ones. We all just go through life and we can learn from each other.
How far do you feel like you are away from the person that you were a few years? How many years ago was it that you wrote that article?
So it was October 2013, I think it was, when I tried to take my own life. And the person I am now, I can't even imagine being the person I was then. Like, it seems like an absolute world away from the person I am now. But the person I am now is what I felt like before I was going through that period. And the kind of the important thing is, when I was going through that really dark depression, I didn't ever think I could be the person I am now. I didn't think I'd be this person again. Because I just thought that my life had just changed, and that I was a different, you know, I'd grown up and I took on responsibilities and I was just a new person. My life had changed and never be the way it is now. But now, like, I've got the life that I've always dreamt of. And but it's important, I think, kind of the key thing really is that I didn't understand what I was going through. I didn't understand what it was. I'd never been taught or prepared for all that. So now I've gone through experience, I understand what it is. And I think if there was ever signs that of getting back to that, I would know.
When we talk about maybe spotting those signs or picking up, you know, issues, when you think back to that point, do you think of a day, a moment where you suddenly felt like those hopes or aspirations you no longer had, or you changed as a person? Or do you feel that was a gradual process? Was there a moment or something which you thought, I don't feel like I used to feel, I don't feel normal anymore, or my normal is now a completely different normal?
Yeah, that was definitely gradual. That was a long time. I felt like it was like every day I'd think, maybe tomorrow I'll be that person I used to be, or what I used to like being, and I couldn't, and it would be weeks and months, and, you know, I couldn't tell you exactly how long it was. The moment when I thought I'm going to end it all, that was a split second decision. That was not something that I'd ever really properly thought about before. But that whole I don't feel that was the thing that hung over me, was I don't feel like I used to. I don't feel like I know I should. I don't feel the feelings. I can't remember what it feels like to actually feel love or guilt or hate or any of those. And that was a long time. It probably felt longer than it actually was, but it was it wasn't a wake up and suddenly I feel like this. It was a gradual thing, definitely.
Did you get your sense at that point, and this is one of the dangers with mental health, that your mind is clear? And your mind is thinking logically, and your mind is thinking in a common sense way. There's danger sometimes when you start thinking that way, because you start to separate the emotion from it, or feel like you don't have the emotion. You almost start to think, well, now I can judge everything purely based on pros and cons and merits. And that's when you start going to a strange place. You remove the personality. You remove the emotion from decisions. So you don't think straight, and yet you start to think that you are thinking clearer than you've ever felt.
Yeah. Well, I went through months of not being able to think clearly. Like, I didn't have... I had thousands of thoughts going through my head all at the same time. I couldn't channel any thoughts, and I was desperate for clarity. I was desperate to be able to think straight. That's just what I wanted. I wanted to have a clear head. And then one day I got a moment of absolute crystal clear clarity, that thought where I had no doubts at all, and it was a loud, clear voice that was to say, kill yourself. And it, that's why at that moment, when I'd been desperate for that moment, that clarity for so long, to then have it, I didn't doubt it, because I thought, this is what I've wanted. At last, there's an answer. At last, there's a obvious route here. And that's when I did attempt it. And that's what's so scary, is that it was so clear to me. And I didn't, even when it took a lot of effort and stuff, I didn't doubt it throughout the whole process. And it was only that I was found before it was too late, that then I was suddenly awoken to everything again. And I was kind of taken out of that moment, and was able to reflect back and to see the reaction that it was going to have on my family and my friends and my mum and dad. And because in that moment, I thought I was doing whatever I was about to do for them, that it would be the best thing for them. And I genuinely, hand on heart, believed that. And it was only afterwards, when I realised that it wasn't. And the tragic thing is that a lot of people won't get to that afterwards point. And that reflection back is what kind of lifted me out of everything, really.
Those statistics that people hear, that have been quoted on this programme, about the suicide being the number one cause of death for young men in particular, you were as close as you can get to becoming part of those statistics. You know, you were essentially part of that statistical group, all but. When you hear, and when you hear people talking about suicide, particularly suicide among young men in your situation, do you feel like that's me? They're talking about me there. That I absolutely understand where that's coming from, and where maybe similar people in that position are coming from. Or do you feel like you still had a very unique experience?
I think we can get lost in generalising statistics. They tell a story, but behind every single number in that statistics is a person, is a life, is a family, is friends, is a turmoil that's personal to them. I went through what I went through, and I genuinely believe that I went through what I went through without really speaking about it or kind of accepting it, because I didn't know. I know a lot about the statistics now, but I didn't know anything about it back then. And I think that's what is one of the main issues that we face, is that, you know, we talk about the stigma that's attached to mental illness, but unless you're teaching kids in school about their mental health, then that stigma will always exist, because every single person in the world has mental health. We all have mental health, just like we all have physical health. And just like our physical health, our mental health can go up, it can go down, and it can happen to anyone at any given time. But if we're not prepared of what to do, of the signs to look out for, of the help that's available, that it's okay, that it's fine to talk. And I don't mean that you're talking to children about suicide, but you can be talking to small children about being worried, about being scared, about being alone or nervous. It's about saying to them from a young age, if you feel these ways, it's okay. That's fine, we all do. And we can all learn from each other, and you can talk to me. But if you're not saying to them that you can talk about it, you're ultimately saying that you can't. You're saying to them, don't discuss this in public, don't discuss this with friends. And that's the problem, really, is that I didn't know what I was going through. I was not prepared. And so many people, well, everyone is going through that same thing without being prepared of what to do.
In terms of your friends group, the people you were sort of knocking around with sort of before and after, did that change at all? Did attitudes change? And then once you told your story, did they change again?
Because I, after speaking out and being quite public, and my recovery, my whole recovery was public, really. Only after doing all that did I start hearing from people, close friends, who were saying, I'm on antidepressants, by the way, or I've felt like that. You know, like best friends, people who I speak to every single day, who text them throughout the day, who never would have mentioned it, but came up to me in a party and kind of just sat there with a pint and then just without really looking at me in the eye. I was like, yeah, no, I've been through that as well. And that keeps happening. You still get people now who are like, don't really know how to talk to you about it, or were like kind of talking code a little bit.
What sort of stuff do they say?
Well, I always remember when the first story came out and it was in the Echo, and so someone came up to me and was just like, you're right? And I went, yeah. And, okay. Good to see you. See ya. And it was like, I knew that he'd seen it, you know, and but people have their own way of talking about it, and that's fine. And I always kind of make a point as well, is that although we're saying talk to someone about it, or, you know, to seek help, no one should feel obliged to speak publicly about it. It's still a very personal thing. Just like being, you know, if you're going through any sickness, it's a private thing, it's a personal thing. And if you don't want to talk about it publicly, that is absolutely fine. You're under no obligation to do it, but seek help from people who you can trust and who you can kind of talk to about. And, you know, as I say, I still get people now who will kind of try and talk about it. And I've now picked up that experience to know when people are trying to talk about it without actually saying a word. So,
did you ever say to your mates, like, well, why don't you say something then?
Yeah, yeah. I always remember one of the scousers' reactions that I ever had about speaking out, about trying to take my own life, was someone came up to me, one of my mates came up to me and said, if you ever try and do that again, I'll kill you myself. And I thought, and that's quite nice.
We got Jake Mills with us on Mental Health Monday. Jake's now set up a charity called Chasing the Stigma. People can type that into their search engine and it comes up. A part of that, you got the Hub of Hope as well, where people can find out some more information. You've got various trustees as well that work with you in your charity. Tell us about Professor Andy Smith.
Andy Smith, there's a lot I could say about him. Most I won't. But Andy came to me quite early on when I was speaking at an event, and he offered me help and advice to channel everything that I was doing, to try, and he gave me support. The most support that I've had has come from Andy to say, you can do something like this, you can make this something, you can make your experience something. He pointed me in a direction. We've had endless amounts of coffee meetings where we've just said, what can we do then? And Andy's been one of the biggest helps that I've had, and is one of the trustees of the charity. And I couldn't have picked a better trustee for the charity, someone who is doing absolutely incredible work around mental health through Till University and even more than that, and he's absolutely dedicated to helping other people, and very proud to call him a friend.
And we'll hear from him straight after Uptown Funk by we're going to get him straight on, Professor Andy Smith. Thank you for your time, Andy. Great to see you.
Hi, Mick.
Was that nice to hear him say nice things to you?
It was, but he's never bought me a coffee, I might add. And
I didn't say
that.
You are? I didn't claim to have bought any coffees.
You're from Edgehill University, but you've done loads of work with institutions like Everton Football Club, things like Tackling the Blues, which is a project that they've got that they're working on at the moment, and various community things that work with normal people, real people. We're talking about real people here, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, I think that really is embodied in the philosophy behind Chasing the Stigma and Jake's charity, really. We set up Tackling the Blues with Everton and the community at Edgehill around 2 years ago, and that was really in response to the needs of local groups, particularly schools, and especially primary schools and secondary schools, who were facing at the time and still do face significant pressure around supporting young people with an increasing range of mental health needs and problems. And what we tried to do for that was to work with our local schools and community groups to see whether we could begin to support them at a time when funding was being ripped out of the system and support for schools was in decline. And we really set off to make a fairly small contribution to support in the area, but the response has been significant. We work now with over 300 young people, 6 to 16, every single week. And what we try to do there is to go out into schools and provide the kind of support that Jake mentioned in relation to mental health and mental illness, because it isn't, we know it's not a compulsory curriculum subject, and yet it's one of the single biggest pressures that children and young people in all over the world, but particularly in the UK, are experiencing at the moment.
So you deal with primary school kids, secondary school kids, you go into universities, you also research elite athletes as well. So it's everybody, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the biggest similarities that you find between all groups, as Jake said, is that they're all vulnerable in some way to mental health difficulties, and they all have mental health. And there are particular kinds of pressures on people at different parts of the life course. But one of the things collectively we've learned is that if you begin to encourage people to recognise the signs and symptoms of mental illness, but also positive, good mental health, that can be beneficial not just for individuals but for whole communities and societies. And that's really the intention of our research that we do at the university, is that we try to impact positively on the lives of people who work with us, but also particularly in the case of children and young people, to help provide that gap that currently exists in mental health provision in the UK.
And spotting those sort of, we'll say, opportunities, but, you know, you do work in universities at the Mental Health Day on the 2nd of March to help students, but also members of staff. And I wonder, at what point do you take that leap of going, well, we're going into university, so obviously we're going to help the students. But then in your mind you go, well, actually, the staff will need help as well. And, you know, you start talking about, you know, grown men who were in working class areas in North Liverpool, but at the same time you think, but also millionaire footballers will also have mental health issues as well. You're sort of crossing little divides there that maybe don't cross over at any other point in any other sort of walk of life.
No, and I think that's precisely the reason why we do what we do, particularly for adults. We focus on the universities, and we've found this also in schools, is that it's not sufficient just to work with young people or children. They're being supported by other people, particularly adults, who themselves are at risk of mental illness and sometimes experience mental illness. And in the workplace, particularly in the higher education sector, stress, anxiety, just like in schools and colleges, are one of the single biggest reasons why people are off work. And one of the reasons why people often call it stress or anxiety, they don't want to admit publicly to having a mental health condition for fear of losing one's job, or for fear that it might affect other areas of their life, including career progression. That doesn't matter whether we're looking at elite athletes or whether we look at teachers in schools or lecturers at universities. The problems and the fears are very similar across all of those groups.
In terms of the work that you do, the different types of work, you're working alongside Jake now in terms of the Hub of Hope as well. If people want to get somebody in to sort of say, right, well, here's how we do things at the moment, where are we at? Are we, you know, promoting positive mental health within workplaces, school, educational environments? Is there a place you can go to?
There are lots of organisations doing lots of things, but what we tried to do when we established Chasing the Stigma and the Hub of Hope was really to provide a central place where people could go to identify the relevant support that would be available locally. Because when you do speak to people about mental health and mental health provision, there's so many organisations, they're not really sure sometimes where to turn. So what we tried to do at the university to support Jake and with colleagues at Everton was really to provide a forum whereby you could put in your postcode, you can find the relevant organisations, and then you could refer, if you were concerned about yourself or other people, to relevant organisations. And the key thing for us is that those organisations remain current and up to date, so you don't hit the button and the link's broken or the organisation no longer exists. These are people who are committed to supporting people in times of need, and that's really the portal that we try to develop to address the needs of people in communities.
Andy, great to get you on the show today. I look forward to sort of hearing some more about the work you're doing, particularly around North Liverpool, which, of course, an old-fashioned working-class part of town, of course, we'll talk about, I'm sure. And, Jake, before I let you go, I've just got to mention the phrase chasing the stigma, people tackling the stigma, chasing it. You've gone with the name chasing the stigma. That you chase something with the intention of catching it eventually.
Yeah. It originally started because I want... before I'd done the charity, I wanted to do something and out of my comfort zone, and that was, I decided, was to run a half marathon, and that's kind of where the idea came from. And I don't want to run anymore, so I'd rather run a charity instead.
Thank you for telling us your story, Jake. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
We'll speak to you again on World Mental Health Day.
Yeah. Can I just make a point as well, as that we're building the Hub of Hope at the moment. So if someone was to go on the website looking for the Hub of Hope, it won't be there, but our contact details are. We have the contacts for a lot of organisations. So just because the Hub isn't there at the moment, as it's getting built, it will be soon. Just contact us and we'll be able to share information with people.
And there's links to all that information through our website, and you can also check it out via our social media at Radio City Talk. There's a link to Jake and Andy. We'll get yours on there as well. People can find out some more information about the great work that you're doing. Thank you to you both for joining us on Radio City Talk. It's Mental Health Monday. More conversations on the way next.
Radio City Talk. Tackling the stigma.
Right, so it's Radio City Talk. It's all about Mental Health Monday. We're talking about mental health issues on the show. We've got some new figures here for the North West that say nearly 4 in 10 people in the region believe that mental illnesses are an inevitable part of life. The vast majority, 84% of people, don't think enough is being done to tackle mental health conditions. Got a couple of people to talk about this with. You may have seen their adverts on the TV very recently, actually. MQ is the name of the group, and the director of research there is Sophie Dix, and Sophie joins us on the programme. Sophie, thank you for your time.
Hello.
I saw the adverts on TV. I thought, hey, there you go, mental health adverts on TV. This is something. This is the new era we're in, about talking openly about mental health.
Yeah, it's been really exciting, actually, to launch our TV and our advertising campaign, because what we're really trying to do with our ReSwear campaign is to channel the growing frustration that people are feeling every single day with the status quo and mental health. So we're joining forces with celebrities to highlight the need for much more research to improve treatments, particularly in young people.
Is there a problem when you get a situation where people are thinking it's an inevitable part of life? That people are thinking, well, fine, we could do something about it, but it's going to happen anyway. That's a concern, isn't it?
It really is a concern, and we really want to challenge that wisdom. We really believe that mental illness is not an inevitable part of life. At the moment, 3 children in every classroom are suffering a diagnosable mental health condition, yet only a quarter of them are getting the help that they need. Now, can you imagine if we were saying the same about a physical health condition, for example, a kidney disease or something, that, you know, 3 children in every classroom are affected, but it's inevitable. We don't really need to do much research. We don't fully understand it. There would be an absolute outrage. Mm. So that's why we're swearing to do something about it.
And you
that's
are,
why celebrities are supporting to swear us.
And you are swearing, aren't you? You are swearing. There's really need for this foul language.
Well, we really hope that we're not going to offend anyone with the language. I mean, we don't put the language anywhere. But we're swearing with it. It's showing our frustration. But the real message is that, you know, we're swearing to tackle mental illness in young people.
Yeah, absolutely.
We swear to support us.
And people can support it using the hashtag #WeSwear. And it's all about giving a blank about mental health, and we absolutely support that. Sitting alongside you, you have Nina Martinchik, who's a mental health campaigner. Nina, I know you've had sort of your own experiences of mental illness. So are you happy to talk about your own situation?
Yeah, so when I was 13 and in year 9, my mum was diagnosed with cancer, and my dad had left the home, and I had a very difficult relationship with him, so I wasn't speaking to him. So my grandparents had to come over from Belarus to look after us, and my mum wasn't really at home because, of course, she was having chemo. And then halfway through year 9, my mum passed away, and I still wasn't talking to my dad, and my grandparents had to go back to Belarus. So I ended up living with a friend and then afterwards having to go into state foster care. So in year 10, I had moved around 3 times, so I had like a lot of instability, and you know, because of all this I developed anorexia, and it was really severe in year 9, but it kind of got better, you know, throughout year 10. But then in year 11 I relapsed completely, and I ended up being hospitalized, and I was also very clinically depressed. So I have definitely experienced a lot of mental illness and a lot of instability, and that's why, you know, I'm lucky because I've got better and I've recovered. but I really want to speak up about it because so many people are still suffering and not speaking about it because they're ashamed, and I find that really, really sad.
I mean, it's a shocking story, if you don't mind me saying, Nina. You know, a terrible set of circumstances which sort of conspire against you at such a key age as well, and that age, 13 through to 15, that's such a vital point in terms of our social development, our mental health development as well. And you were dealing with all those terrible things, with the bereavements and the social issues, the family issues as well. And that must have been just an awful, awful time. How do you look back at it now?
To be honest, it makes me feel really sad because, you know, I did have a mum. So I knew what it was like to be loved and cared for. It's not like I never had that kind of love. And it does make me really, really sad. And it makes me kind of desperate to speak up about it, because I don't want anyone else suffering. And it's sad that, you know, I know so many of my friends, you know, suffered mental illness or also have been in foster care. And, you know, right now, obviously, I'm talking about mental health. And I'm just trying to basically spread the message that it's nothing to be ashamed of. Like, speak up about it, guys. Like, there's something wrong with you. Do you know what I mean? Because it's just an illness like everything else, and it's sad, but people can get better.
No, absolutely. And we really, you know, thank you for sharing your story with us today, Nina. We really appreciate that. Sophie, people can support this campaign and find out more information through your charity, MQ. I think it's going to be an organisation we're going to be hearing a lot more about in the coming weeks, months and years.
We certainly hope so, that we're a small charity, but we have very big ambitions, because we've really seen what investment in research can do. I mean, take, for example, the example of HIV. In the 1980s, we believed that HIV was a death sentence. But, you know, the government put a lot of money at it. People really raised awareness. Everyone talked about it. A lot of money was put together in bringing scientists together and creating a coordinated response to it. And now, with access to the right mental health services, the right medical services, it's possible to live a healthy, normal life, even with a diagnosis of HIV. And that's all because of the investment in research. And we really, really want to do the same for mental health.
Excellent. If people type in MQ to any of their social media facilities or any of their search engines, they get all the information there with the hashtag #WeSwear. And we'll get that up on our social media feeds through our Mental Health Monday feeds that we have as well. Sophie, Nina, thank you for your time. Thank you for speaking to us today.
That's great. Thank you very much.
Mental Health Monday with Mick Coyle.
This is Radio City Talk.
You're listening to Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle. You'll see plenty of those hashtag #WeSwear adverts on TV and also in newspapers as well. Great to support that campaign. Hashtag #WeSwear. Show your support if you want through social media too. Now, if you are listening to this as a podcast, you'll be aware that it also goes out as a live radio show. But this bit is just for you, because we have loads of different guests on over the course of the week talking about mental health matters. And we'll tie up those interviews and put them into this podcast too, so you can get a sense of some of the other issues we're talking about from the news, where mental health is a big factor, including this story, which is about young people in the city of Liverpool. By the way, if you've got a story of your own or you want to share your own experiences with the programme, drop me an email, mick@radiocity.co.uk. That's mick@radiocity.co.uk. That's my email address. Your emails will come through to me. If it's an email of a personal matter, that's absolutely fine. You don't want it reading out on the radio. That's fine. Just make it clear in the email. Otherwise, if it's maybe an insight into a story we've been talking about, or your own personal experience that you want to share, obviously in a public forum of a podcast, then drop me an email and make it clear on the email that you're happy for me to read that out. mick@radiocity.co.uk. If you want to share your story, absolutely, this can be a place for you. It's Radio City Talk, and it's Mental Health Monday.
Radio City Talk. Tackling the stigma.
We're going to talk about now a new service which will provide therapy to children and young people who have suffered trauma and neglect. This is all going to be put forward at a cabinet meeting at Liverpool City Council on Friday, and it's to the tune of more than £500,000. Let's get a take on this now with Barry Kushner, who's a Liverpool Labour councillor. Barry's going to tell us about this new therapy service. What sort of children are we talking about helping here, Barry?
These are children that have suffered quite significant trauma, and we feel that if we can offer some kind of therapy, some counselling or psychiatric support, that we could avoid them ending up in care. And that's really what the purpose of this is.
So what sort of situations have they found them in? Is that domestic situations they've found themselves in? Is it personal tragedies they may have experienced?
I think it's a combination of those things. I mean, I can think off the top of my head of sort of young people who have had lost their mother and their father, another significant adult, you know, drifting into sort of criminal behaviour and quite sort of serious antisocial behaviour. And all the sort of support that's been provided from them when they've been excluded from school and the alternative education provision, you know, there's some therapeutic need there. Otherwise, those children are about 11 years old. If we don't intervene there, and I've seen it before, they will end up in a situation where there's no other option but for them to be in care.
Well, I was going to say, because some of that, I mean, the concern that when children find themselves in that situation, terrible circumstances, and they are just children, you know, they are in no way, shape or form responsible for the situation they find themselves in. But as a result of being in that situation, more likely to miss school, more likely to be excluded from schools, more likely to be sexually exploited or become vulnerable to that one, more likely to have a problem with alcohol and drug abuse as well. That's... They're serious long-term impacts on a child's life based on something over which they had absolutely no control.
Yeah, of course. And you know, these things happen when families are in crisis. You know, so there might have been, you know, there are also examples I could give of where families have had to deal with the suicide of one of their children in the family or brother or sister. So dealing as an, you know, in that immediate circle and trying to understand and deal with that is really... You know, can be really difficult. Your children, as well, although we focus on, you know, the victims of domestic abuse, children often observe the kind of things that are going on. They may not have been physically abused themselves, but they've seen it. And that in itself obviously leaves some sort of traumatic legacy behind. And we need to, you know, it can come out later in life. It's not an automatic causal relationship here, but it can come out later in life. And I think if we can provide that therapeutic support where it's particularly difficult, we know that the crisis is leading to other difficult and complex issues within a family and for children, then I think we can, yeah, we can have an impact.
In terms of how that therapeutic services work and that early intervention, if you want to call it that, works, what does it look like? What does it sound like? How many people does it involve?
Well, we're probably looking at around 50 a year, I think is what we're sort of looking at, because it's quite intensive work with children. We're talking about the offer of counselling, psychiatric support, so that's there for them to be involved with the family in trying to resolve the issues that they've got. So it's kind of, it's more than we can offer at the moment through our intensive outreach service, which is that kind of crisis support, trying to help families when they're in real difficult need. But following that through to make significant change to that family so that, you know, hopefully that we can get them back on their feet again.
Is there a danger that if you take a child who's been in a terrible situation, one of, say, domestic violence or a suicide within the family maybe, and you put them into a therapy session and you take them to a counsellor and you start giving them appointments and, you know, have half an hour every, you know, second Thursday, that the child starts to go, well, I've got a mental health problem. And actually part of this is that they are so young. Is there a way of doing this in a sort of a way which kind of makes sure all the checks and balances are there, but the child doesn't feel like they're becoming the focus of psychologists or the mental health profession, even though it's obviously going on in the background?
Well, we don't want there to be a stigma about it. I mean, I think from my point of view, I'm the cabinet member for Children's Services. I think what we want to offer families is a resource. Yeah, we don't want people to think if Children's Services are involved that there's going to be as a punishment on the way or that their kids are going to be taken away. We've got professional staff that can help families. And the main thing that we want to do is keep families together and keep children at home. And that's really what we're trying to offer with this service. I mean, in my own professional life, you know, I did some elements of this when I was working in youth justice. And I think if you build a relationship with young people and giving them the opportunity of expressing themselves in all sorts of different ways through games and drawings and music and all sorts of different ways of drawing things out of them that they need to talk about, then it can work in that way.
Well, I was going to mention that because, of course, you can go through these sort of therapy sessions, services, psychology, or whatever it would be, and you can have positive outcomes and the negative outcomes might still be there, but you don't know to what extent they could have been worse. And I wonder whether or not there's it's hard to judge the success of something like this one. Was that child a very happy, jolly little kid growing up? Great. Did she maintain that into adult life? Absolutely fantastic. Equally, a child who has suffered a trauma for whatever reason has still suffered a trauma, so still has that going on in their lives, which may emerge at any one point. So is it about maybe just highlighting that the issue has been looked at and that they've been given a little bit of guidance in terms of how they might focus on that? Because no. It might flare up again. You know, it might become an issue, and it's not something that can be sort of knocked out of them.
It might, and I'm coming to work this morning, I was listening to a report about cognitive behavioural therapy, and I think although they've probably overstated the impact that it has, but there was a 20-year-old girl who suffered from significant mental health problems. She's 20 now, when she was 15, and she feels she's kind of got to a point now where she can deal with, you know, the voices that she hears in her head and the other mental health issues that she faces. And I think you're right, and you know, you can't stop people getting mental health problems in the future, but what you can try and do is give them the tools and understanding of themselves to be able to deal with those issues as they move forward in their life. We know there's a pattern of young people and families that we've been working with in similar situations, and they have ended up drifting into social care, into residential care. So we can only, everyone's an individual, everyone's got their own story and their own experience, but that's the only way we know that what we can do. And the only way of judging it is that if we set an outcome together with the child and the family, then we need to achieve that outcome, and this gives us an opportunity of doing it when the issues that we're dealing with are particularly difficult.
Does social class play a factor in these situations?
Of course it does, and we'll be speaking about this tonight in council. You know, the issues around mental health don't always stand alone. You know, the social determinants of health are right there. We're in a city where a third of the children, you know, living in child poverty. In some of the wards, it's up to 50%. And all of those kind of issues that throws up a difficulty, obviously, and can end up leaving children with mental health problems, and so of course it plays a role in that. We know that it does.
There is a cabinet meeting on Friday, the 20th of January, whereby the council has been asked to earmark this cash. We're in austere times at Liverpool City Council, as people will be well aware. Is this cash available though?
This is money that we're using from our troubled families budget. So this is money that we get direct for government to target at what they've identified as, they're called troubled families. I'm not quite comfortable with that phrase, but that's what it's called. So we're using that funding, which is kind of sort of grant funding, if you like, to target it in a particular way that will have a benefit for us later on in terms of saving money for us from what we're spending at the moment in residential care.
And when we talk about early intervention, how quickly, once Friday's meeting gets a tick or the money gets the go-ahead, at what point can you then go, right, well, here are the people, here are the individuals, here are the people that we want to help?
Well, I think obviously we know who it is we want to help. I think this is going to be a commission service, so we'll have to go out to tender, probably take, I don't know, 3 months or so to get it up and running so that we can start offering that service, because we'll have to buy that service in because it's new. And that will be the only delay, so that'll happen straight away.
Barry Kushner, thank you for your time today. Thank you for telling us a little bit about this. And if people want to find out beyond that, I'm sure through social media and things like that, that the council will be letting people know exactly what those services are. Liverpool.gov.uk has got all the information from a council point of view, and the council Twitter feed up and about as well.
Radio City Talks Mental Health Monday with Mick Coyle.
And that wraps up episode 3 of Mental Health Monday. Some real great work going on right around the region and around the UK. You might be involved in these sorts of organisations. Do tell us your stories via mick@radiocity.co.uk. You might just be a person in your own regard with an idea or something that you want to say or add to the show, to contribute to the show. Absolutely get involved. That's @RadioCityTalk. You can get involved on Twitter. And my own Twitter is @MrMickCoyle. We're also on the email as well, mick@radiocity.co.uk. So however you want to get involved in the show, fire in your questions, fire in your topics, fire in your points, whatever issues you want us to raise on the programme, and we'll do our best to tackle them very soon. Mental Health Monday, back next Monday on Radio City Talk.
Mental Health Monday on Radio City Talk. Tackling the stigma.